Okay, so imagine this, right? You're in prison, and you're told you have to take medication, even if you don't want to. This isn't some sci-fi movie. This was a real situation for Walter Harper. And his case, Washington v. Harper, it ended up going all the way to the Supreme Court. It set a precedent that is still, to this day, being debated.
It really brings up some like really fundamental questions, about individual rights, state power, and like how does mental health even work within like a prison system?
It's a huge can of worms. Let's actually get into Harper's specific story. So, who was this guy?
So Walter Harper, he was incarcerated for robbery. And at some point, he's diagnosed with schizophrenia. And initially, he was actually okay with taking antipsychotic medication. But then in 1985, he was moved to a special unit for prisoners with mental illnesses.
Okay, so what happened? What made him change his mind?
Well, that's where Washington State's policy 600.30 comes in. So this policy, it basically set out the procedures for when they could give medication to prisoners involuntarily. And the psychiatrist at this new unit, he wanted to start Harper on meds, even though he didn't want to take them.
So it wasn't just like one doctor deciding on their own, right? There was a whole process they had to go through.
Exactly. 600.3 wasn't like just a quick thing, It had all these steps. Like they had to give the prisoner 24 hours notice. They had to have a hearing with a whole committee, and the psychiatrist, they had to actually prove that the prisoner was dangerous, like to themselves or others, or if they were what they called gravely disabled.
Now, wait, I'm not sure what gravely disabled means in this case. What does that even mean?
So basically, it means that because of their mental illness, the person can't like take care of their basic needs, like food, shelter, being safe, to the point where it's like really dangerous for them.
Oh, I see. So it sounds like this policy was trying to find a balance between like making sure people get treatment, but also giving them some kind of like fair process for.
Yeah, exactly. Like the prisoner, they had the right to show evidence, they could talk to an advisor, and for the committee to make a decision, it had to be a majority vote.
So I'm guessing Harper wasn't exactly thrilled about all of this.
Yeah, you guessed it.
Well.
He really felt that being forced to take medication was like a violation of his rights. And he actually took his case to court, arguing that the whole process was going against his due process rights under the Constitution.
And just for anyone who might not be a legal expert, due process basically means you have a right to a fair hearing. You can challenge things, present your side of the story.
Yeah, that's a perfect way to put it. And you know what? The Washington Supreme Court actually agreed with Harper at first. Yeah. They ruled that he had to have a full judicial hearing before they could give him medication against his will. But that win didn't last very long.
Oh no.
The case then went up to the U.S. Supreme Court, and they had a whole different opinion.
That's where things start to get really interesting. What was like the main question the Supreme Court had to grapple with?
So the core issue was, does the Constitution always require a full-blown, like, judicial hearing before you can give medication to a mentally ill prisoner who doesn't want it? It's about finding that balance, between individual freedom and what the state needs to do to keep the prison safe and orderly.
Yeah, that's a tough one. So what did they decide? How did the Supreme Court end up ruling on this?
So they actually reversed what the Washington Supreme Court said in a 7-2 vote. They said a full judicial hearing wasn't always necessary. They came up with a three-part test to figure out when involuntary medication was okay under the Constitution.
This seems important. What were those three parts?
Okay, so first, the prisoner has to have a serious mental illness. Second, they have to be dangerous, either to themselves or to others. And third, the treatment, the medication, it has to be medically appropriate.
So it sounds like they were saying, okay, prisons are different. You need a slightly different approach to due process when you're dealing with that kind of environment.
Yeah, for sure. The court, they acknowledge that prisons are, like, by nature, potentially dangerous places. And the state, they have a big responsibility to make sure everyone's safe in there, both the inmates and the staff. But they also made it clear that the prisoners' rights still matter.
So how do they make that work? If a full hearing isn't always needed, how do you make sure a prisoner isn't being taken advantage of?
Well, they really focused on those steps, those procedural safeguards that were built into policy 600.3 DIR.
Right.
You know, like having the committee review, making sure a psychiatrist does the evaluation, mm-hmm. giving the prisoner a chance to have an advisor. And they decided that these were enough to protect Harper's due process rights, basically saying, look, there's a system here, and it's designed to prevent, you know, random or unfair decisions.
I bet there were some people who didn't quite agree with that decision.
Oh, absolutely. Justice Stevens, he wrote a really strong dissenting opinion.
Yeah.
Arguing that policy 600.30 didn't really offer enough protection.
Mm-hmm.
He saw that dangerousness standard as being way too vague.
Okay.
And thought it could be misused really easily.
Yeah, I can see that. I mean, this whole case basically comes down to how you define dangerous, and that can be pretty subjective.
Exactly. And Stevens, he wasn't alone in having these concerns. Justice Blackmun, he wrote a separate opinion where he kind of agreed with the outcome,
mm-hmm.
but he wanted a more, I guess you could say, a more thoughtful approach. He said that for inmates who are found to be incompetent,
okay,
they should have formal commitment proceedings.
So even within the court itself, there were different opinions on how to best balance individual rights with keeping things safe and under control. This is shaping up to be a fascinating deep dive. We've set the stage for understanding Washington v. Harper, but we've only just scratched the surface.
Right.
So what's coming up next? Where do we go from here?
So in part two, we're going to look at like the ripple effects of this decision, how it created this thing called the Harper standard,
okay,
how that standard is being used in other cases,
mm-hmm.
and this big debate about who should really be the one making the final call in these situations, doctors or the courts.
This is getting good. Make sure you join us for part two, where we'll really start unpacking Washington v. Harper. All right, so welcome back to our deep dive on Washington v. Harper.
Yeah.
We've just gone through Walter Harper's story that really detailed policy 600.30 and, of course, the huge Supreme Court decision.
Right.
So now let's kind of shift gears and think about the long-term impact of this whole case.
Yeah, Washington v. Harper. It wasn't just about, like, resolving that one legal fight.
Right.
It actually created this thing we call the Harper standard.
Okay.
Which has been super influential in a ton of cases about involuntary medication, even outside of prisons.
So this Harper standard, can you break that down a little?
Yeah.
What exactly does it involve and how does it actually work in, you know, real life situations?
So it basically comes down to that three-part test we talked about earlier.
Right.
You know, the individual has to have a serious mental illness.
Uh-huh.
They got to be a danger to themselves or others.
Mm-hmm.
And the treatment, the medication, it has to be medically appropriate.
Right, yeah.
But it's not just about checking those boxes, you know. Mm-hmm. The Harker standard also says you got to have these strong procedural safeguards in place.
And why are those safeguards so important? Like, what's the big deal with those?
Well, they're there to protect individual rights and make sure nobody's being taken advantage of, you know? It's about things like making sure the person is properly notified, giving them a chance to speak their mind, and having ways to review their treatment regularly.
Mm-hmm.
It's a way to balance the state's interest in keeping things safe and providing care, but still respecting the person's autonomy, their ability to make their own decisions.
That makes sense.
Yeah.
You know, we want to make sure people get the treatment they need, but not if it means completely ignoring their basic rights.
Exactly. And the cool thing is, the Harper standard, it's not just limited to prisons, you know?
Really? So this isn't just about prisoners' rights then?
Nope, not at all. It's been used in all sorts of cases about involuntary medication in different situations.
Wow. Okay. Are there any, like, big examples that come to mind?
Yeah, there's a really famous one, Cell v. United States.
Okay.
This one focused on a different but kind of related question.
Uh-huh.
It was about whether the government could force medication on a defendant who's mentally incompetent to stand trial.
So we're talking about people who are waiting for trial.
Yeah.
Not those who've already been convicted.
Right.
So what were the main legal issues in Cell?
The big question was, does the government have the power to forcibly medicate someone just to make them competent to stand trial?
Mm-hmm.
The court said, yeah, the government does have an interest in bringing people accused of crimes to justice.
But there's got to be a but here, right?
There definitely is.
Okay, good. I thought so.
The court in Cell set a much higher bar for involuntary medication compared to Harper. You know,
okay.
Like they said the government has to prove first that the medication is very likely to actually make the defendant competent.
Yeah.
And second, that it's the least intrusive way to do it.
So it sounds like Cell, even though it used Harper as a foundation,
yeah,
it actually put in even stronger protections for defendants' rights.
Exactly. the courts, they get that we're talking about some really serious stuff here, you know?
Yeah.
A person's mental and physical autonomy, that's not something to mess around with.
Absolutely.
Sell basically says, even if the government has a good reason, you can't just toss aside individual rights that easily.
It seems like when it comes to this whole involuntary medication thing, the courts are having to make some really, really fine distinctions, you know?
Yeah, for sure.
This whole conversation about both Harper and Sell, it keeps coming back to this central tension, right?
Yeah.
The power dynamics between doctors, the courts, and the individuals who are actually being affected by these decisions. Like, yeah. Who should have the final say in all of this?
That's the million-dollar question, isn't it?
It really is.
On the one hand, you want to trust the doctors, right?
Sure.
They're the ones who are trained to diagnose and treat these mental illnesses. They have an ethical obligation to do what's best for their patients.
But, and I feel like there's always a but with these tough ethical issues.
I'm getting good at this.
Well, you're a good teacher.
But yeah, doctors are human, right?
Of course.
They can make mistakes. They have biases. They're influenced by outside pressures, just like everyone else. Just like Justice Stevens warned in his Harper dissent, there's always a chance that medical authority could be misused, especially in places like prisons where people's freedom is already so restricted.
It's a tough spot to be in, right? Like, damned if you do, damned if you don't.
Exactly.
So if it shouldn't be just the doctors, then should the courts have the final word? But then again, judges might not have the medical knowledge to really understand these complex situations.
That's the dilemma, isn't it?
Yeah.
If we give too much power to the courts, are we ignoring the crucial role of medical expertise?
Right.
And if we put too much emphasis on what doctors say, are we sacrificing important legal and ethical protections?
It's like we're walking a tightrope.
Yeah.
Trying to find that sweet spot between all these different values and perspectives.
I like that. Walking a tightrope. That's a great way to put it. And honestly, that's what the legal system and society in general is constantly struggling with. There's no easy answer, no magic solution. Harper and everything that came after it, it forces us to face these really tough questions head on.
So we've covered the Harper standard itself, how it's been used in cases like Sell, and this whole debate about who should be calling the shots. But I feel like there's more to this story, right?
Oh, absolutely.
What else do we need to consider as we keep going with this deep dive?
In part 3, we're going to get into some of the criticisms of the Harper standard, and we'll look at some real-world examples that show just how tricky these ethical dilemmas around involuntary medication can be. It's a conversation that needs a lot of careful thought and nuance.
It's like we're about to get to the heart of the matter. Join us for part 3, where we'll keep exploring all the twists and turns of Washington v. Harper. All right, so welcome back to the deep dive. We've been, really digging into Washington v. Harper, starting from Walter Harper's fight and going all the way to the ripple effects of that Harper standard.
Yeah.
But, you know, as with pretty much any big legal decision, there are always going to be people who disagree or have concerns.
Right.
So let's talk about those.
For sure. I mean, no legal standard is perfect, right?
Yeah.
And the Harper standard, it's got its share of criticisms. Like, one of the big ones is that it might give too much power to prison officials.
Mm-hmm.
Which could put mentally ill inmates at risk, you know?
Yeah, that kind of goes back to what Justice Stevens was worried about in his dissent.
Yeah.
He was concerned that forced medication could be used as a way to control people.
Yeah.
Instead of it being about actual medical treatment. And it's easy to see how that could happen in a prison, right?
Yeah.
The power dynamics are already so messed up.
Exactly. Critics say that it's really hard to make sure someone is giving genuine informed consent in a prison.
Uh-huh.
Even with those procedural safeguards in place, there's always that risk of coercion or manipulation.
Right.
Like, imagine the pressure an inmate must feel knowing that if they refuse medication, they could get even more restrictions or even punishment.
It's a no-win situation almost.
Yeah. It's tough. And that dangerousness standard we keep talking about, it sounds simple, but it can be so subjective.
Totally.
Like, who gets to decide what counts as dangerous behavior?
Right.
How bad does it have to be? Critics worry that because it's so vague, prison officials could interpret it way too broadly, which could lead to people being medicated when they don't need to be, or even as a form of punishment.
That's scary. It's like we're constantly trying to balance this need for safety and security in prison with the fact that inmates are vulnerable.
Yeah.
And we have to protect their rights, you know?
Absolutely. And this whole thing gets even more complicated when you think about the stigma around mental illness.
Mm-hmm.
People often just assume that anyone with a mental illness is automatically dangerous or unpredictable.
Yeah, it's a huge problem.
And that can lead to decisions being made out of fear, which ends up hurting the people who actually need help.
So the Harper Standard, even though it was supposed to help balance all these competing interests, it might actually be making some of those problems even worse, like a paradox.
It is, kind of. But, you know, there are people who support the Harper Standard, too. They point out that it at least acknowledges how hard it is to keep things safe and orderly in a prison,
okay,
while also trying to respect the autonomy of the inmates who have mental illnesses. They say it's a necessary compromise, you know, given how difficult the situation is.
So they see it as, like, the best we can do in a less than ideal situation.
Yeah, basically. They argue that prison officials have this responsibility to provide medical care to everyone,
yeah,
and that includes mental health care. Sometimes they say involuntary medication is the only way to keep everyone safe, the inmate, the other inmates, and the staff.
I bet they would also bring up those procedural safeguards again, right? They'd say those are there to prevent abuse.
Exactly. Things like the committee review, the psychiatrist's evaluation, those are supposed to add extra layers of oversight.
So it's not like there are no protections at all.
Right. And it's important to remember that the Harper Standard isn't just some isolated thing. It's part of a bigger system of legal and ethical guidelines that try to help people make decisions about involuntary treatment.
This whole deep dive has really shown one thing. There are no simple solutions when it comes to involuntary medication.
Yeah.
It's a mix of legal precedents, medical ethics, individual rights, societal fears, all tangled up together.
Couldn't have said it better myself.
Yeah.
Washington v. Harper and the whole Harper Standard, they still cause a lot of debate and legal challenges.
Yeah.
This isn't just some old case in a textbook, you know?
Yeah.
It's still relevant today, and it has real consequences for people's lives.
So after all this, where do we stand? What's the main message our listeners should take away from this?
I think the most important thing is to be thoughtful and to keep talking about this stuff.
Yeah.
It's not black and white, you know? We have to really grapple with the complexity, question our assumptions, and try to find solutions that respect people's dignity and keep everyone safe.
Very well said. This deep dive into Washington v. Harper has been really eye-opening.
For sure.
It's a good reminder that even the biggest legal decisions don't always solve these debates for good. The conversation has to keep going, and we all have a part to play in figuring out how to handle these issues in the future.
Absolutely.
Thanks for joining us on The Deep Dive.